From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. President Barack Obama made his historic first address to a joint session of Congress last night.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.
After long applause and a standing ovation, the president spoke frankly and directly to the American people about the current financial crisis.
But while our economy may be weakened and our confidence shaken, though we are living through difficult and uncertain times, tonight I want every American to know this. We will rebuild, we will recover, and the United States of America will emerge stronger than before.
So will Mr. Obama's speech have the same impact as the first of President Franklin Roosevelt's fireside chats back in 1933? Joining me to discuss this and the week's political news is Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania and the former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, and Robert Trainum, the D.C. bureau chief for the Comcast network CNN, host of Roll Call TV, and a professor at George Washington University. Robert, Mary, nice to see you.
Nice to be with you.
So last night's address was President Obama's opportunity, let's say, to lay out his agenda for the next 4 years and to reassure Americans that his economic recovery plan will lead the country in the right direction. Robert, how did he do?
You know, overall, I think he did pretty good. I mean, on a scale of 1 to 10, with 1 being not so good, 10 being phenomenal, I would say I would give it a 7. And the only reason why I would give it a 7, not an 8 or 9, is because he was a little short on the specifics. There were, quote-unquote, typos in his speech. He misspoke twice, according to my account. One, he had said that the American ingenuity spirit had created the automobile. That's not accurate. And he also said that the GI Bill was founded during the Depression, and that's not accurate as well. It was founded after World War II. But nevertheless, it was a very good speech in terms of being optimistic, in terms of being forward-thinking, and also addressing the critical crisis that we currently face ourselves in from a financial perspective.
So, Mary, if those were the only mistakes, if we could call them that, those aren't big ones, are they?
No. They were not big mistakes. I think in overall terms, it wasn't truly inspirational speech. He's been in campaign mode for the last few weeks, and he does an excellent job when he does that. And the Democrats were in a celebratory mood. The mood was so different from what it was when Bush came to speak to the Congress. And as far as Franklin Roosevelt, Roosevelt's speech inspired people, his fireside chats, and he also, the first programs that were enacted by the Congress, did relieve suffering and create jobs, although the historical record is that they didn't really get us out of the Depression, but they were helpful to millions of people who were in very bad shape at that time.
Now, the president laid out quite an ambitious agenda last night. He pledged to deliver health care reform. He pledged to retool the regulatory system and to overhaul the auto industry. But he talked also about the problems of the perception that Americans have about our banking system. And he directly addressed the public's outrage over the industry's excesses and corruption.
So I know how unpopular it is to be seen as helping banks right now, especially when everyone is suffering in part from their bad decisions. I promise you, I get it. But I also know that in a time of crisis, we cannot afford to govern out of anger or yield to the politics of the moment. My job, our job, is to solve the problem.
But that's the big issue, isn't it, Robert, whether or not the people are, do they get it?
Well, you know, one of the things that the president tried to do last night, and I talked to some of his aides yesterday and on Sunday, and that was they tried to, or they wanted to portray a president that was speaking in plain English so that the American people out there can get it and connect the dots. And he did do that last night. The real question is whether or not the American people understood what he was saying, but most importantly, agreed with what he's saying. And according to the polling data, 80%, this is a Gallup poll that I'm citing here, 80% of the American people liked what he said, but about 55 to 60% are still a little skeptical, not 100% sold on his ideas so far. So only time will tell as to whether or not the American people out there, you know, in the Midwest and the South and so forth, really understand what the president's trying to do.
Well, one of his major problems, Tony, is that the people who he appointed who are around him, like Tom Geithner at Treasury and Larry Summers and various other people in the administration, were a part of the problem that was created and are closely tied to the banks. And there are some suspicion which is fired up by the talk shows and the hosts and the Limbaughs and the people on other places, that people don't really know if these people know how to fix something that they were part of messing up. And that's sort of undermining the message that the president delivers, because some people say, well, if he gets it, why does he have these people? Well, his answer is that these are people who have experience, who know how to fix it. We'll just have to see.
Well, Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal, to follow the point that both of you are making, who, by the way, is a rising star in the Republican Party, although the speech last night may or may not have helped that star continue to rise, delivered the Republican response to the president's address. He has been, of course, a vocal critic of the president's stimulus package, and he used his response to critique what he considers wasteful spending.
Democratic leaders say their legislation will grow the economy. What it will do is grow the government, increase our taxes down the line, and saddle future generations with debt. Who amongst us would ask our children for a loan so we could spend money we do not have on things we do not need? That is precisely what the Democrats in Congress just did. It's irresponsible, and it's no way to strengthen our economy, create jobs, or build a prosperous future for our children.
It raises the question, Robert, who the public believes, who does the public have faith in? Last night, the president attempted to sway the public to his point of view. Jindal's response, how effective do you think that was?
Well, you know, rhetorically, I thought Governor Jindal's speech last night was flat. And I can't tell whether or not perhaps we all put him on this shelf that was just way too high and he didn't meet those expectations, or if, in fact, we put him on the shelf and he just, you know, hit below expectations. But the bottom line is I would give that speech a 4 or 5. It just was not very clear and not very succinct. However, he did speak in very common English and very common language that I think the American people can understand. To answer your first part of your question, Tony, as to whether or not, you know, who's in control here from a power standpoint in terms of the people's trust, I think that pendulum switches back and forth. There are some people out there that believe that this president is on the right track. He's doing the right thing. He is inserting himself in this crisis and doing the right thing. But there's others out there that are cheering House Republicans specifically who have not supported this president's economic plan. And the governors out there, Republican governors, who have said they're not taking the money. So I would say right now, just from a rhetorical standpoint, it's a 50-50 draw.
You know, Mary, I heard Ed Rollins, a former Reagan White House aide, say very sarcastically last night about Jindal that was a speech that would make Sarah Palin happy looking towards 2012. What was your reaction?
Well, Jindal, who is a nice guy, and I spend time in Louisiana, and most people down there who vote for him love him. He's smart. He's delivered on most of his promises and the like. It was the speech was bad. It was flat. But I think that if Rollins meant that Palin fires up the troops and gets them moving and gets them interested, and Jindal doesn't seem to have any fire, then I think he's right about that. But what I wanted to say was that President Obama has high approval ratings, as reflected in the Gallup poll, although there are, 50-something percent who don't really know whether his ideas will work and are worried about it. All new presidents have high approval ratings, and when they have won by a landslide, they have really, really high approval ratings. But those dissipate rather quickly, depending on what happens. So now I think the American people are willing to put some confidence in what Obama says as compared to what the Republicans have to say, led by Jindal and others, for now. But if there isn't some payoff fairly soon as time goes by, I think his poll numbers will start to erode. So let's hope that doesn't happen, because we all hope that the economy will get better.
Tony, can I respond to that very quickly?
Yeah, go ahead.
Look, the president said on numerous occasions last night, and rightfully so, that this is a problem that we inherited. I mean, and I think that was one of the strongest applause lines that he got last night, is when he repeatedly said, look, this is, well, he didn't say this, but he implied that this is not my fault. However, we have to deal with this issue. And I think the American people understand that. They understand that this is not Obama's fault, but obviously he is now in control. And so it now becomes his fault to a certain degree, because he is now has to get us out of this problem. My point is, and I think Mary just said this, the American people are willing to give him the benefit of the doubt, and he has a honeymoon now. The question becomes is how long does that honeymoon last?
But there's one other point that to make, and to be fair and to be objective, it was a bipartisan failure that got us into this. Many of the things that were passed that deregulated the banks were passed with the support of Democrats in Congress, like Senator Schumer of New York, and
Barney
Senator
Frank.
Dodd, and others. And President Clinton knows this, that it was a bipartisan agreement to do a lot of deregulation and, you know, so that free enterprise could do its work and all the rest. So the mess that we got in, Bush led the way, making the mess more than anybody else made mess. But in fact, some of those people who were sitting in the Congress watching as the president was speaking know that they, too, were part of the problem.
Well, I agree with that.
Certainly it was an interesting appearance last night on many levels as we bring this conversation to a close. One of them, of course, being that apparently President Obama is the first African-American to ever address a joint session of Congress. So that was history in the making. And I suppose every day that he remains as president is another history-making day.
Now, Tony, he was the first African-American president. He wasn't the first African-American. As I recall, I think Nelson Mandela spoke to a, well, I don't want to quibble about this.
Yeah,
but
well,
he's the first African-American president to speak to a joint session of Congress.
All right, we'll look into the history books to make sure. But I know that Sirleaf Johnson spoke and Mandela, but African-American was the one that separated Obama last night. I appreciate all of you coming on. Thank you very much. We'll get together again next Wednesday.
Thanks, Tony.
Mary Frances Berry and Robert Trainum in the D.C. Bureau. This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. As President Obama laid out his economic agenda in a primetime address last night, the internet was lighting up with reaction. Jeffrey Bennett is the digital producer for News and Notes, joining me now to tell us all about it. Hey, Jeffrey.
Hey, Tony.
So describe the reaction online to President Obama's address.
Well, on our blog News and Views, a reader named Jerry Meyer said he wanted to hear more about the president's plan for advancing the nation's standing in math and science, but last night did advance the marriage of social media and politics. CNN.com and Facebook united again last night for the first time after inauguration and allowed people to connect and discuss the president's address as it streamed online. And last week, you know, we talked about the social networking site Twitter and the growing popularity of that site. And a few House members who were actually in the chamber last night as the president was making his address were sending updates from their BlackBerries. So Senator Claire McCaskill of Missouri, for instance, wrote, quote, quite an ovation as the president walked in. The warm greeting between President Obama and Secretary Clinton makes me proud of our democracy. What a difference a year makes.
Wow, that's interesting. Yeah. Times have really technologically changed, I guess you would say. I understand the White House has named the team that is heading up the president's internet and new media efforts.
Yeah, they announced the core of their online team. Most of those people were actually already involved in the campaign and transition team. And the core team includes five people who have titles like Director of New Media and Director of Citizen Participation. And most of these folks worked for politicians or for political advocacy groups before they worked for Obama.
And what else is capturing attention on our blog this
people
week?
People are still talking about that controversial New York Post cartoon, which they said sought to spoof the economic stimulus bill. Some people saw it as racist. And we also want to hear from people about what they want to hear from us in these final weeks of our show being on the air. And they can send their ideas for segments, story ideas, and interviews to our blog or through our Facebook page, News and Notes.
Can I throw you a curve?
Sure.
All right. I don't want to scare you, but I would imagine that the White House would have a way of dealing with spam that maybe the rest of us don't have. Do you know whether or not they do in terms of blocking that kind of unwanted internet access?
For emails to the president or emails to staffers?
Yeah, both, yeah. Do they have a way of stopping that we don't have
well,
yet?
Well, most business networks have pretty sophisticated spam systems. So I would assume that, you know, as good as NPR's is, theirs would be even better.
Okay, I would think so, too. I know it's a little bit of a curveball. I just was curious about it. Thank you very much, Jeffrey.
Sure, no problem.
Jeffrey Bennett is the digital producer for News and Notes. He joined me in the studios of NPR West. Now on to our bloggers roundtable and some of the hot topics they're talking about online. Is the GOP headed for a hip-hop makeover? Plus, our bloggers weigh in on the reported Rihanna Chris Brown altercation and the chatter over Disney's first black animated princess. With us, Brandon Whitney of the blog Homeland Colors. He also writes about politics for the websites Black Men in America and My Voice DC. Mark Lamont Hill, a professor of American Studies at Temple University. He blogs at marklamonthill.com and at The Root. And Carmen Van Kerkhove, she blogs at Racialicious and heads the anti-racism training company New Demographic. Hello, everybody.
How you doing?
Hi there.
Hey,
I'm fine. Thank you. Let's talk about Michael Steele and the Republican Party first. The newly elected GOP chairman is planning a public relations campaign to attract younger voters, he says, especially African Americans and Hispanics. Now, this group will be targeted by applying, according to Steele, the GOP's principles to, quote, urban, suburban, hip-hop settings. So what's been the reaction, Mark Lamont Hill, to both Steele's chairmanship and to his ideas for luring young black and brown voters to the party?
Well, I think there's some excitement, not from people on the left or from black people, but certainly people on the right. There's some excitement about Steele's chairmanship because they feel that it sort of moves the GOP into a new generation of leadership. To some extent, that's just a sort of very narrow idea of what it means to have new leadership. They just, and it becomes almost like a racial subtext where they're saying, really, we just have a black guy in front too, and so that can help us. The hip-hop thing is a little curious to me because I think what Michael Steele misses is that one of the biggest problems with the GOP in this election has not been the fact that it needed a hip-hop makeover as much as they needed a different set of issues to confront. This generation of people aren't as absorbed with these so-called moral issues around gay marriage and abortion and stem cell. Those things aren't galvanizing a generation of voters to vote against their own economic interests the way they have in the 80s. So I think Michael Steele needs to focus on some new issues and not so much the hip-hop makeover.
Well, when you talk about, Carmen, about hip-hop and the GOP, is that squeezing a round peg into a square hole or vice versa?
You know, it's so tempting to caricature folks like Michael Steele as sort of out of touch, crotchety players, but some of those quotes from that interview were really, really embarrassing. And I know that we've been discussing it on Racialicious, and there is just a general sense of bemusement. But, you know, I mean, clearly the GOP does need to do a better job of reaching out to people of color. But at the same time, I have to feel like people of color who lean conservative really deserve, you know, better spokespeople than folks like Michael Steele or Alan Keyes.
Well, Brandon, let's look at it from another perspective. What should they do? What can they do to try to expand the party and reach into the base?
Well, be honest. Just give honest approaches. You don't have to put spinners on your car to talk to young people who of color. You just need to talk to them honestly and sincerely. And hip-hop, what does that even mean? We're going to touch the hip-hop demographic or do it in hip-hop. What does that even mean? I mean, he's an old black dude. He probably listened to the Shylights and stuff like that when he was young. He didn't know.
Oh, wait a minute. The Shylights, they were pretty
There's
good.
There's nothing wrong with him. But I'm now. Just mean he's not hip-hop. I mean, he's an old, and you don't have to pretend that you are. He just needs to be honest. And the GOP needs to do that. And there are a lot of, if we're honest about it, there are a lot of principles in the hip-hop generation that they could probably latch on to in terms of entrepreneurship and things of that nature. But just be honest. Don't try so hard. It's corny.
All right. and I do like the Shylights. I do like the Shylights. All right. We spoke of Bobby Jindal in our earlier segment. Just briefly, Mark, how do you think his appearance resonated with this target group last night, including immigrants?
Well, I think Bobby Jindal, in many ways, is a much better sort of representation of what new school GOP leadership should be, even than Michael Steele. You know, the one piece about the hip-hop piece, just to connect it, is that, you know, Michael Steele is right that you need to make being Republican cool again. It needs to be hip again. And what Bobby Jindal represents is fresh young leadership that sticks to GOP values, even if we ultimately disagree with them, but has a fresh look. I think what he said last night, even though I disagree with almost all of it, was, I think, resonated with the party's base. I'm not sure it'll reach out to immigrants, but it certainly resonated with the party's base in the sense that they're pledging their allegiance. They're saying that we're part of the loyal opposition and we're willing to work with the president, but we want to push back against things like the stimulus bill. I think his presentation was great, and if I were a GOP honcho, I'd be very happy with what Bobby Jindal did last night.
Carmen, how do you feel? Because as I was watching him, I was reminded of how Barack Obama some years ago got on a national stage and delivered a great speech that got people to look at him in new ways. Do you think Bobby Jindal was able to do that with his remarks last night?
Well, from the reactions I've seen, not quite. Seems like the reactions range from lukewarm to really just bad reviews. So I do think that clearly the GOP is trying different things, and we'll ultimately just see what sticks.
All right, let's move on to another GOP politico who's been making news this weekend. More news on the Republican front via the person Alan Keyes. You remember him. He ran for president twice in 1996 and 2000. He also ran unsuccessfully for the Senate a few times, most recently against Barack Obama. And he's been saying all sorts of things since Obama's election, including last week releasing a video saying that he refuses to acknowledge the validity of Obama's inauguration.
Obama is a radical communist, and I think it's becoming clear. That's what I told people in Illinois, and now everybody realizes it's true. He is going to destroy this country, and we're either going to stop him or the United States of America is going to cease to exist.
So, Brandon, you're blogging about this. Does anyone take Alan Keyes and his comments seriously?
You know what some people probably do, which is unfortunate. The first thing about Alan Keyes is he's proof that black people don't just vote for somebody because they're black. So we can kind of throw that stereotype and lie out the door. Second of all, what does he mean by he must be stopped? I don't see where he's going with that, because Barack Obama was elected president. You can't stop him until the next election. So what does he mean by that? But I think we also have to kind of discredit what he was saying. First off, communism is socialism established by violence. So since he was elected, first off, there's no way he can be a radical communist. Second of all, I mean, he's not a socialist. But the thing about Alan Keyes is I think his problem is that it's got to hurt if you are a radical right-wing Republican and you're black and you took a lot of flack to be that and you felt like you probably had to give away a lot of what people see as African-American culture to get to that point. And then somebody who didn't have to sell off their portions of their culture became president. It's got to sting a little bit. And I feel like a lot of what that vitriol coming from is a little bit of jealousy.
Well, in the United States, Mark, the First Amendment guarantees Alan Keyes and anyone else the right to say whatever they'd like. But is this kind of criticism inappropriate? Does it go too far?
I mean, of course it goes too far. Is it inappropriate? No, I mean, if anything, I think it just places a spotlight on this sort of right-wing fringe body of people who don't, you know, operate in the realm of reality. You know, every day I get email. I mean, literally every day I get 50 emails from people. Sometimes it's the same 20 people and then 30 new ones who will tell me that Barack Obama is really a secret communist. He's still a covert Muslim terrorist. I mean, I get these emails every day, and it's partly because I work at Fox News, and it's partly because, you know, people just kind of circulate that stuff. And there's a small bite of people that believe that. And for the next 4 years, you will see that. You will see a fringe group of people, but I don't think they matter that much. And in fact, I think if anything, it makes the GOP look bad. And Alan Keyes isn't really in the GOP anymore. I mean, he's really moved even to the independent space.
That's true.
You know, but even still, he identifies with those principles and those values, and as such, it doesn't make Obama look bad. It makes the right look bad because they get, you know, sort of lumped into this group of nuts.
Let me circle.
Yeah, and Hawaii's been a state for 60 years for all those who aren't sure if it's a state or not. So being born there still makes you a citizen.
Let me circle back really briefly to Michael Steele before we go on to our next topic. Last week, a firestorm erupted over an offensive cartoon in the New York Post that equated a monkey with the president of the United States. The paper apologized. The GOP chairperson was conspicuously silent on that controversy. Now many are asking why Michael Steele hasn't said anything about Alan Keyes' comments. What are we to make of this, if anything, Carmen?
Well, I'm not particularly surprised that he's been silent, but then I think it also begs the question, do we really expect Michael Steele to respond to anything that happens to any black person? I'm not really sure that's a realistic expectation for his kind of role. And particularly when it comes to the New York Post, I mean, the New York Post is unabashedly right-leaning. So it doesn't surprise me that Michael Steele wouldn't join in this chorus of criticism. And you know, we should add that, you know, not all of the criticism has been unanimous. Not everybody feels that the cartoon is racist. I certainly do, but not everybody does.
No, everybody does not. Let's move on to another topic completely unrelated to this. Last week, photos of a battered and bruised Rihanna were splashed all over various websites, people raising the question of whether or not news outlets should have even published them. But let's talk about something different. She has now become the face of domestic abuse, like it or not. And there are rumors floating that she may not press charges against Chris Brown for the alleged attack. Mark, does Rihanna, as a public figure, have a responsibility to press charges against her alleged attacker?
I wouldn't go so far as to tell her, say that she has a responsibility because she's a celebrity. I think anyone who is in that circumstance has the right to press charges and indeed should press charges. I think they have every right to do that, and they should. I would be disappointed if she did not because of the message that it would send to the broader sort of public sphere. So it would concern me if she did not. But I don't want to place that burden exclusively on this, you know, 21-year-old girl's shoulders because she's a celebrity. She's in an abusive relationship, and in abusive relationships often produce people who are unwilling, who love the person they're with so much that they operate against their own interests. She's a case study in this, not, so I don't want to, you know, heap upon her any extraordinary burden. I would just say really fast, the thing that's concerned me the most, though, has been this public response to this sort of, there's been a lot of protectionism around Chris Brown, and there's been a lot of conversation. When it first came out, there were rumors that she had given him an STD, and people said, oh, well, then that explains it, as if that is a reasonable excuse for domestic violence. And so I've heard too much justification in the blogosphere and in the broader public sphere around domestic violence to make me comfortable with this circumstance.
We're going to explore this even further with Judge Lynn Toler in an upcoming segment later in this broadcast. But for now, Brandon, what message do you think it sends if Rihanna chooses not to press charges?
You know, I'm not sure what message it sends, but it wouldn't be atypical of what happens. I mean, in the United States, women are beaten and raped all the time, and it's something we never pay attention to. It happens constantly. I can name numerous occasions where I've viewed and had to call the cops. So it's something we as a country need to deal with. It's not even just racial or cultural. This is a problem in the United States. Women feel as if they've done something wrong when they're beaten or raped, and they shouldn't feel that way, but they do. And that's not necessarily their fault. That's our fault as a culture for putting a stigma on people who are abused. So I think it wouldn't be atypical. I think it sends a message, hopefully, that there's more that we need to do to fix this type of situation.
Well, Carmen, rap music has been criticized for being violent and for its misogynistic lyrics. Neither Rihanna nor Chris Brown are rap artists, but they are in the hip-hop community. What impact, if any, do you see that photo having on impact? Not just the photo, but the incident itself having on hip-hop?
Well, I think certainly hip hop has its own set of problems when it comes to gender issues. But, you know, I have to agree with Mark that one of the most shocking themes that you've seen out of the public reaction is the sense of, well, what did she do to deserve this? And then, you know, when this rumor about the STD came along, there's the sense that, oh, well, that explains it. And so, you know, again, hip hop definitely has demeaned women. But at the same time, it's a reflection of some of the bigger problems throughout society. I mean, domestic violence, domestic abuse is a massive, massive problem. And, you know, the culture of victim blaming really extends beyond the world of hip hop.
Well, we'll have to keep our eyes on it to see how this develops. I appreciate all three of you coming on. A good conversation today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We've been talking with Carmen Van Kerkhove, who blogs at Racialicious. She was at our New York studios. Brandon Whitney of the blog Homeland Colors. He joined us from our headquarters in Washington, D.C. And Mark Lamont Hill, who teaches American Studies at Temple University. He blogs at marklamonthill.com as well as The Root. You can find links to their blog as well as to our blog at nprnewsandnotes.org. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. Back in the early 90s, sociologists coined the term underclass for the disenfranchised urban poor, those without social support or any real job opportunities. A privileged few blacks, mostly men and mostly under 40, have now turned that label on its head. Dripping with wealth, with poverty not a distant memory, they have forged a new class of their own. Wall Street Journal reporter and CNBC correspondent Lee Hawkins has given this echelon of black wealth a name, the overclass. His one-hour documentary, Nubos, The Rise of America's Black Overclass, can be seen tomorrow, February 26th, on CNBC. Lee, welcome to News and Notes. Nice having you on.
Thank you.
You coined this term, the black overclass, in your film. What sets the overclass aside from, let's say, the black upper class?
Well, about 3 years ago, I started writing my book, which comes out later this year. And really, the focus was to look at this new emerging class. Because when you think of the black upper class, that's the Huxtable generation. That's the doctors and the lawyers. But there wasn't really a term for this other group of young African Americans that are building wealth in the sports, entertainment, and media industries. The Sean Combs, the Jay-Z's, the LeBron James, all of these individuals have become very wealthy at a very young age, at a very fast pace, and it brings along a great deal of sociological challenges, and it also provides opportunities for them to be entrepreneurs.
Let's talk about that, as a matter of fact. The first of your subjects who we meet is Brian Baby Williams of Cash Money Records. He calls himself, quote, hood rich, and he says this is the epitome of the American dream. Here's a clip from the film that hits on this very point.
You know, having money brings on a lot of greed, a lot of different type of people, but as far as the family and us being able to get out the project, buy houses for our moms and cars and put money up for our kids, that was the American dream. That would make me appreciate it more than anything. I could set a new tone for my children. They don't have to grow up like I grew up.
You know, let's talk about him for a moment and how you would describe him, because he's with this company that's made, you know, millions and millions of dollars. But when so many in this country are struggling, it might be hard for people to see his success with $500,000 of minerals in his mouth, literally, and understand what he's talking about.
It is probably difficult because, first of all, the image and the perception of the young black male in America is something that is different in terms of it, when it comes to economics. But these individuals are insulated from some of the problems of the broader economy. If you look at Brian Baby Williams, that company got a $30 million deal from Universal Records as an independent record label in 1999. Ever since then, they put out an album every month, okay? Their last album from Lil Wayne sold 1 million units in 1 week. That's in a music environment where that just doesn't happen. And so these are entrepreneurial geniuses, but they just have a different face. They don't look like Warren Buffett.
No, they don't, because as I said, he's got $500,000 in platinum in his mouth, and he's got 15 carat earrings on each ear.
Yeah, and when you look at the way that he makes his money off of an annuity-like function, such as royalties, syndication, things that operate, that continue to pay individuals. When you make that record in 1999, fast forward to 2009, they're still making money off of those records that they made in between.
That's what you call new money, isn't it, and not wealth?
It is new money, but to a certain extent, that's the great challenge here. How do these young individuals deal with being the first generation in their family to acquire this kind of wealth? What obligation and responsibility do they have to their family? What obligation do they feel they have to their community and to Black America?
Now, you also talk with Major League Baseball star Torrey Hunter of the Angels, who we learn lives in a 20,000 square foot home. I think it's in Texas somewhere. He talks pretty candidly about the other side of new wealth, friends and family members coming out of the woodwork looking for handouts. Here's a clip.
Man, 90% of my phone calls are, Tor, how you doing? You know, this and that. Is everything okay? You know, you had a great season. You're doing this. Man, you can really play. But look here. When I hear that, that's a trigger. Man, I have
I'm about to break it down for you.
Now, I have this situation, you know, this and that or whatever. And that's when I'm like, wow, I can't believe this is happening again.
As you hear these people from him, LeBron James, Terrell Owens and others, is this the beginning of the building of a new class, a new wealthy class in Black America? Or is this just an example of people who have money and is going to more transiently pass through their hands and just disappear somewhere?
It's undoubtedly a new generation of new wealth. These are not doctors and lawyers. These are 70% of the Black athletes in the NBA made more than $1 million, and the average salary was over $4 million. In 2007, the salaries of all Black athletes in the NBA, NFL, and in Major League Baseball totaled nearly $4 billion. So that's, when you add the top 20 hip-hop moguls, it's $500 million. So that's $4.5 billion in the hands of a few thousand young black men in 1 year.
One of the things that defines people of wealth in the majority community in many ways is their philanthropic activities. And a sign of how wealthy you are is how much money you can give away. You deal with that somewhat in the documentary through Kirk Franklin, the gospel artist who talks about giving back. Here's what he said.
How many more chains? How many more cars? One Bentley can put computers in an inner city school to help kids that are struggling with educational programs that are not being funded by the city. We can take our wealth and put it back into our communities.
So we hear Kirk Franklin saying he's giving money back. Is he representative of what the others in the so-called overclass are doing now?
Charity comes in different forms. In America, we talk about, when we think about charity, we think about writing a check. We don't think about the idea of assisting family members. It's almost become a cliche in the black community for a baseball player like Torrey Hunter to purchase a home for his mother when he gets the first check. When Torrey Hunter signed his initial $450,000 deal in the minor leagues, his mother's electricity was turned off. So that was the first thing that he did. He purchased all of his brother's homes and set them up with educational funds to go to college. And so what they're doing is they're taking care of family first. We have to keep in mind that these are young people that are in the early stage of wealth accumulation. The wealthy people that you're talking about are philanthropic to the greatest extent when they're older, when they're starting to kind of wind down their careers. That's when they do that. These individuals are trying to maintain and grow their wealth.
One of the people that you mentioned is in the documentary is billionaire Robert Johnson of BET and Hilton Hotels and the Charlotte, well, they're no longer the Charlotte, but the, well, yeah, the Bobcats. And one of the things that he said that I'd like to get you to respond to was the joke that his a lawyer friend told him that if black people owned all of the companies in America, there would be no need for antitrust laws because these folks would never get together to do anything as a group.
That's a major theme that we address in the special. It's a theme that I address in the book. And what he's talking about is the need for more economic collaboration. When you talk about a generation of young people, a class of young people that have made $4 billion in 1 year, that provides a lot of opportunity for people to launch businesses and business ventures together. This is the other side. These are people who have overcome vast obstacles to achieve vast success. And in this economy, we can all learn from these individuals. And that's the message that we're trying to impart in our special.
Lee, good job. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Lee Hawkins. He is a Wall Street Journal reporter and correspondent for CNBC. His one-hour documentary, Nubos, The Rise of America's Black Overclass, can be seen tomorrow, February 26th, on CNBC. He joined us from the studios of NPR in New York. To hear and read about the reported violent altercation between singers Rihanna and Chris Brown is one thing, but to see the leaked photo of Rihanna's bruised face takes the horror of date violence to another level for young fans. Or does it? Does your daughter still have a crush on Chris Brown? What impact has this case had on young people? And what responsibility do these celebrities have to speak to the issue of violence against women, if any? It is the subject we toss to our regular contributor, Judge Lynn Toler. She is the star of TV's Divorce Court. Hello, Lynn.
Hello. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you very much. You've worked with and counseled young women for a long time. You've been a judge ruling in cases just like this. We know that Rihanna hasn't pressed charges against Brown so far. The word on the blogs suggests that she may still be in love with him. If that's the case, Judge, what do you say to a woman who is in love with a man who beats her?
The first thing I say is, it's not her job to press charges. It's the state's job to do that. In a criminal matter, the state brings charges. And when I was in court, it was a matter of my prosecutor wouldn't drop the charge whether or not the woman would cooperate. We've got photos of you being beaten up. We got the witness information from the police and who was ever there. And we as a society say we are not going to tolerate that. So whether or not you're still in love with him is irrelevant, because now I, Lynn Toler, Judge Toler, the state of Ohio, is saying to you, we will not have this. Having said that, the difficulty lies not so much in that guy, but the society and the way we women look at things and how society puts us to look at things. And, you know, women as equals and not chattel is a relatively new thing when you think about it on a human historical terms. So we have to retrain ourselves to retrain young girls from the cradle up. And young boys.
Even if the state is the ultimate decider of bringing charges or to not bring them, as a witness, which she would be, doesn't she have a role to play?
Absolutely, she has a role to play. I've seen them all the time. They get on the stand and they minimize what he did. I started it. I this. I that. And the other thing. But people can see through that when all the physical evidence is there. Sometimes they can, you know, well, I started it is no justification. So she does have a role to play, but society has a role to play as well. The dead guy can't speak on his behalf, but we still prosecute homicides.
So how much of this is private and how much of it deserves a public airing out?
It's all private because it's all her and it's all him and it's all theirs. But since they are public figures, it has turned public anyway. And if nothing else, Chris Brown is a conversation with your daughter. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm absorbing it. Go on.
He is where you start, because it's hard to start like, oh, just by the way, one day you're going to fall in love with a guy and he could hit you. And if he does, you ought to go. But what you should say is, look at who she was and what she had and what she took. Let's talk about how you feel as a girl and all that being in love with someone who is not the best thing for you. If nothing else, he is that conversation you should have with your son and your daughter about what it means to be in a relationship and what it means one blow you go, which was my mother's thing. Is she trained us in that way. I don't want to go there because we've been there. We already got in trouble for that.
Yes, we did. but I understand the point that you make. She drilled that into us.
One blow you go, you don't examine, you don't wonder, you run and you come home and then we talk from there. And that needs to be, you have to have a line in the sand that is clearly drawn from a young age, and I don't think that happened.
It must be very difficult, Lynn Toler, because I would imagine that even in her own life, somebody's probably told Rihanna this and Chris Brown this as well, and yet these things continue to happen.
Well, you know, I had a group of 30 young girls, and I said, how many of you plan on being abused when you grow up? Of course, nobody raised their hand. So I said, what do you think the difference is between the idea that none of you want to be abused and the fact that 50% of you probably will be at some point or another? And we had a long conversation about that, and it is about that nickel and dime effect of, if I just do the right thing, just a little more, that Eve thing, there was something that I did to deserve that. We need to start early with boys and girls talking about what the solution to the problem is and where that line of the song, the sand is. Don't say, I'm not going to be abused, saying the moment he lifts his hand and places on my face, so it's clear. It's not amorphous. It's not vague. It's clear.
And what do you say to the young men to help them to know that this is not something that a behavior you want to engage in? And how do you teach them how to find alternative ways to express themselves when they are in the moment and there is great anger?
I think especially when you're talking about 19-year-olds, you must speak to the ego and say there is nothing more unmanly than to hurt a woman. I mean, because they are so young and their emotions pop up on them so quick, so they have to have a firm and constant reaffirmation of the fact there is nothing more unmanly than that. And not only that, it doesn't matter if your girlfriend is not going to press charges, because society is so horrified by that, we will come for you on her behalf, whether she wants us to or not.
We've only got a minute or so left, Judge Toler. I'm wondering, is this the kind of case, the case between Rihanna and Chris Brown, that would call for a restraining order?
Absolutely. And I used to give restraining orders, and I used to also require women. I said, listen, once I give this restraining order, you can't come in and ask me to lift it, because 48 hours later, there they'd come. I mean, it was like clockwork, because I would want them to have an opportunity for the domestic violence center that I had plugged into my court to give an opportunity to talk to them and help them and give them the vision that they needed before they decided to let him come back and start begging again.
So it works if they don't lift it.
It helps. I'm not going to say anything worked, but it helps to give them room and time and something to intervene in between I hit you and baby, I'm so sorry.
Judge Toler, thank you very much. This is very helpful.
Thank you.
Judge Lynn Toler is the star of TV's Divorce Court and author of My Mother's Rules, A Practical Guide to Becoming an Emotional Genius. She joined us from the studios of KJZZ in Tempe, Arizona.